Welcome back to Shattering Mist. I'm your host, Johnny. You can participate in this program, express your views, or ask questions by calling toll-free 877-300-7645. That's something that Kirk, calling in from California, has done. And I apologize, Kirk, we couldn't get you in that last short segment, but they say the floor is yours.
Yes, sir. I appreciate that. Before I ask my question, you know, my wife and I really got tickled about the Angel commercial. did they think you have a big audience or something in your for that kind of stuff?
That's SRN News. The commercial that's embedded in the midst of the news, it's SRN, the Salem Radio Network, as opposed to GCN. The GCN ad that followed it was kind of snake oil, but I'd much rather snake oil than. Can you imagine that? I mean, you're actually trying to convince people that there's a true story. And they called it a true story about angels that were training to do their job interacting with humans. And that if you listen or watch their presentations of angels in training interacting with humans, that there will be some positive benefit on behalf of your soul. It's just disgusting.
We're untrained.
Can you imagine saying that the Malak, who are Yahweh's envoys and have been with him from our perspective for 14 billion years, haven't been trained because who are they taking orders from? I mean, it's not like they're taking orders from George Bush that couldn't pronounce nuclear. They're taking their orders from God. come on, they're in training to do this job. And it kind of inferred that, if you pay attention to them, then you too can become an angel in training. I'm sorry.
You don't want to be an angel.
No, because that would be
a demotion.
Of course. And that's the, and Kirk, you're absolutely correct. The big issue with the difference between Malak and us is that while Malak are more empowered than we are, and they're immortal, most of us are not, we can become more empowered, and we can also become immortal, but we have something that they do not have that makes us infinitely more valuable than they are, which is free will, and the opportunity to form a relationship with Yahweh, and where the Malak are implements that God uses, we, when we embrace the covenant, become his children. Now, if you want to, you're comparing the difference between a lawnmower and your son.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of importance here. So, yeah, to go from being a son or daughter to being the lawnmower that the dad uses, that would be a demotion.
Yes, sir.
You betcha.
Last night, I had a couple of questions, but I don't want to get too far off topic. But last night, I was reading about the Yobel year.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand how vital it is in prophecy, obviously, mm-hmm. especially for 2033.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I understand about the forgiving of debt so we can return to Yah, etc.
Mm-hmm.
But what I was asking, if they actually put it into practice, if we had actually what does that mean as far as, I understand that you're trying not to build up organizations or people of great wealth, so they have great power, Rockefeller, that type of thing.
Right, correct.
But in practicality, I mean, you buy a house, you build a house, and if or you have a note or something, I mean, it really works.
Yeah, I know. It's an interesting question. Let me backtrack here because you obviously, Kirk, understand what the Yobel represents and how it plays into Yah's timeline, and therefore you very quickly presented it. But the vast majority of our listeners aren't as well informed. And there's so much we can learn from the Yobel. Would you mind if I just, before I answered your question, take a little time and explain the Yobel and what it represents? In his annual invitations for us to meet with him, the fourth of those is seven sevens plus one day from Matzah. or 7-7, seven Sabbaths from Bukurim. You know, the path to God begins with the doorway that's labeled Passover. The next step is unyeasted bread, where we are perfected. And the third step is firstborn children, where we're adopted into Yahweh's home, so that on 7-7s, which is the annual model for the Yovel, on the timing of the Yovel, 7-7s plus one from Matzah, we are enriched with God's teaching and empowered with His Spirit. So that's the annual model is Shavuah, the celebration of weeks or the promise of the Shabbat. There is also a presentation of it in years where we have a sabbatical year where there are certain things that God wants us to do to help those who are less fortunate and to invest more time prioritizing our relationship with Him. And then there's a model of the of Shavuah that takes place twice a century. And it's 7-7s plus 1 year. Well, 7 times 7 is 49 plus 1 is 50. So it takes place every 50 years. Every 50 years, according to Yahweh, is a Yovel year. Now, the most interesting thing about the Yovel, because they are based on sevens, is that there are, if you look at the number that that God tells us repeatedly is a time of the duration of a period of knowing or testing, which is 40, rain for 40 days and 40 nights. The Israelites wandered in the wilderness for 40 years. Yahushua was tested out in the wilderness 40 days and 40 nights. 40 is the number. 400 years multiple of that is the time that the children of Israel were slaves in Egypt. If you multiply 40 times 50, what do you get?
2,000.
Correct. And so now if you look at from the time that Adam and Chawa were expelled from the garden, where they were in a perfect relationship with Yahweh, the Garden of Great Joy. And if you go 2,000 years from that time, where do you end? Where does
Abraham.
That take you? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. In fact, not just Abraham's life.
Abraham, but the offering, when he offered.
Absolutely. Yeah, when Abraham was asked to go to Mount Moriah with his son, his only son, and make a sacrifice, trusting Yahweh. Well, and then Yahweh said, "Don't take your son's life. I will provide the lamb." And then if you go from that establishment of the covenant, that's the day that the according to Yahweh, the covenant is firmly established with humankind through Abraham. Monumental event on God's calendar. What happens if you go 2,000 years from 1968 BCE? Where do you end up? You're going to add 2,000 years, another 40 Yovel to 1968 BCE when Abraham affirmed the covenant on Mount Moriah. Where do you end up?
I'm going. My brain's going, dude.
Okay. Well, 2,000 plus 1968 is 33 CE because there is no year zero. And so if 1968 BCE is year 2,000, 2,000 years after the time that we were expelled from the garden.
But then we get to 2033, yeah.
Right. Then 4,000 Yah would be 33 CE. Just happens to be the time that Yahusha walked into Jerusalem to fulfill the first four Moed Mikre. Pesach, Passover, unyeasted bread, matzah, Bukurim, firstborn children, and Shavuah, the promise of seven. And so 2,000 years from the time that the covenant was ratified with the humankind through Abraham on Mount Moriah, Yahusha enabled the promises of the covenant, the benefits of the covenant in year 4,000 Yah, 33 CE, in Jerusalem. Now, what happens if you add 2,000 years to 33 CE? Where does it take you?
Now we get to the return in 2033.
Right. Year 6,000 Yah, when Yahusha is going to, as Yahweh, this time undiminished, is going to fulfill the last two, Moed Mikre, the Day of Reconciliations, when he reconciles his relationship, his covenant relationship with Yehudah and Yisrael. And then 5 days later, he fulfills Sukkah, which means to camp out, so that we get to camp out with God for 1,000 years, which will commence from your 6,000 Yah to your 7,000 Yah. So that's the timeline. So the Yovel provides the timeline It's not just the Yobel years, but 40 times these 50 years that provide the most important events in human history. Now, the Yobel itself is interesting. You mentioned it. The Yobel, God asked for the following things on the Yobel. He says, I want all the debts forgiven. Now, that's symbolic of him forgiving our debts, of course. He said, I want all slaves freed. That's his concept. You know, Paul wrote that the Torah enslaves. He's a nincompoop. The Torah doesn't enslave. It's the verse is true that, and Yahweh was leading his children away from slavery through the first four mikre and his Torah to freedom is God's perspective on it. And so his Torah liberates. And so the purpose of the Torah and its path is to liberate us. And so the second aspect of the Yobel is that all people are freed. Now, the third aspect of it is the one that you asked about and how it would play out economically, which is the land is returned. In this particular case, Yahweh is only talking about his land, which is Yisrael. So the first two, I think we can apply effectively to economic terms, which is what your question was. How do you apply? Because the purpose of the Yobel, I mean, it's not to to create an economic plan. Its purpose was to manifest the plan of God. How on these Yobel years, of which the next one is 2033, that Yahweh fulfills his plan to free humankind, to forgive our debts, and so that we can live with him. But now the question is, if we were to apply this to our economy, and in fact all of God's guidance regarding industry to our economy, what would we have? Well, the first thing is, and you already mentioned it, we'd have we'd make it very difficult for individuals to accumulate enormous amounts of wealth and pass it on to their children. You would never have the Vanderbilts or the J.P. Morgans or the Rockefellers. God's plan is impossible because
Queen Elizabeth.
Queen Elizabeth. You can't have that under his plan. Yeah, you can't have royal dynasties that pass on their wealth to their descendants because all debts are forgiven. All individuals are freed, and so. It's what it does is it enables each generation to have the individuals within that generation try to achieve all that they can. I mean, it's a free enterprise, if you will. You get to achieve and accumulate whatever you can, and then at the end of that time, it's all even again. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Mess. We have Kirk having called in from California, and Kirk, one of the things just is interesting before we continue with your subject, which is the Yobel, is the very fact that you use the term Yobel distinguishes you as somebody who knows and understands as opposed to someone who has been misled, because you won't find the word Yobel in any English translation of the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. It's you know what the term is? Jubilee.
Jubilee.
And in fact, you mentioned Elizabeth and the fact that...
her big Jubilee ceremony, and not too long ago.
Yeah, that's correct. She just had a Jubilee ceremony. It's all based on a corruption of Yah's testimony. Yobel is really an interesting term, and that it's one of about 50 names in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms that use a contracted version of Yahweh's name. It's Yah-oh is the first two syllables of Yahweh's name. And all of the Yob, for example, which we corrupt to Job, and Joel, which would be Yoel, that all of those names are a contracted a portion of Yahweh. Yah's name, and then some other aspect that is being communicated, and here it's Yahweh's Lamb is God is the most complete unraveling of the contradiction of Yobel. So it's what it is God telling us that there is a an affinity between Yahweh as the Passover lamb and the truths that are being revealed, the freedom from slavery and the freedom of from debt that is being afforded by the Yovel years. So that's the reason why the name is as it is.
You know, if I can interrupt just a second, the biggest thing that happened when I started reading Yada Yah years ago, about 6 years ago, I guess it was now, almost 6 years, is that the thing that sent me off away from Christianity immediately was Yah's name.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was my trigger. I know you have a different trigger, but that to me was just how dare.
How dare.
How dare. You don't know it, but when you think about it,
your trigger,
every word, they changed every name, and every name tells a story.
Correct.
I mean, I'm preaching to the choir here, but I mean, every name tells a story.
Yeah.
And if you study the old, which I find really fun, the Paleo-Hebrew alphabet,
right,
and you take all of those letters, and every one of the dead gum letters, I don't mean root, but every one of the letters, when you write down every meaning by every letter, I mean, you take one of the words, because I have a Torah that's written that way, you can take every one of the words with every one of the letters, and you just forget whether you know the word or not, even look up the word. Just write down the symbols and what all the symbols mean and put the word together, and it's so simple.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, it's deep, but it's simple.
Right.
I mean, gosh, guys, come on.
Yeah, I know. It's, you even look at Yahusha's name. You have the arm and hand. He begins it by saying, this is the arm and hand of God, is Yahusha's name, the first letter, the Yod. The authority and influence of God here to reach out to us and to lift us up. And then the Wa is the tent peg. The purpose is to secure us, to enlarge his family, which is what the tent peg represented. The SH, the shin was depicted with the teeth, which was the conveyance of words, right? It's not only nourishment, but the conveyance of words. So he's the living embodiment of the word of God, reaching out to us to make us secure, to save us, if you will. And then, you know, it even ends with the Ain, which is drawn in the picture of an eye, which means if you can view Yahusha from this perspective, then you're going to understand what Yahweh is doing in our lives. So every word. You're right. They not only tell a story in the original alphabet, which was all designed graphically to convey the meaning of the words, but all of the names in and of themselves tell a story. And every bit of that has been robbed from Christians by having their publishers, the Christian institutions, changing all of the names. Now, you are right in saying that that God's name was not my trigger. It is God's trigger, however. So your perspective on this is identical with God's. God says that the single greatest crime that has ever been perpetrated against humanity was the removal of his name from his witness and the replacement of his name with the name of Satan, the Lord. And so God's view and your view, Terry, or excuse me, Kirk, are absolutely identical. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're having a conversation with Kirk. And Kirk, before we talk about how that Yahweh's name ought to be a trigger for everyone, not just you, I'd just like to conclude your comment on the Yovel, because we got two-thirds of the way there.
Sure.
I think your comment was, you know, how would it work if we were to apply Yahweh's economic thesis, the Yovel, to our modern world? And what I wanted to share was that you understand, I think, how if debts are forgiven and people who are indebted to others are freed every 50 years, that all of that works such that individuals can strive, they can be industrious, they can create and build for themselves and for their families, but that the end of what is a kind of a normal industrial lifetime, about 50 years, you know, from your late teens to your late 60s, you can just go gangbusters. But at that time, rather than passing on wealth and building these huge fortunes, then it's your children now have the opportunity to do the same thing, but individually.
But now, could you not pass on anything to your children in that regard? I mean, if you built a business, I built a little tiny one,
mm-hmm.
but would does that dissolve the business, or do you not keep any of the business?
No. I think what it does, and let me speak about the house, the land, and your reference to the house, and then we'll talk about what we could pass on. Is that what God's talking about in terms of a return of the land is large holdings, so that in back in that day, the religious priest, from his perspective, the Kohen, which were his ministers, they couldn't own any land. So, but there came a time when, with rabbis, and the chief priests began to own large tracts of land. The Roman Catholic Church today owns large tracts of land. So religious institutions, but also, political institutions. Like in the West, the majority of the land in the West is owned by the government. And kings owned enormous swaths of land. And he's saying, you know, I don't want the government. I don't want wealthy industrialists. I don't want politicians or clerics claiming vast tracts of land like they existed in Europe, where they had the feudal system. So it's an indictment against the feudal system, if you will. But it's not saying that, you know, if you provided a home for your family, that home is turned back over. And he's talking about the large and the significant malfeasance of developing, you know, gargantuan fortunes.
I wouldn't think he would break up the home, but I was thinking about business as far as how that would actually play out in a world that actually paid any attention to it.
Yeah, in for most of human history, and even today, there are tens of millions of slaves around the world, and slaves are the means to production in businesses. Now, of course, we have employees, but still, slavery around the world is extraordinarily popular, even today. In fact, there's an article that I'm going to report on in future shows on slavery. And a lot of businesses are built on debt. And I think what God is saying here is that, you know, if the debts are forgiven and your employees are empowered, they're free to and no longer dependent upon your business, that, you know, that which you built, you can certainly pass on to your children, you know, so long as it's, you know, not a railroad where you own vast swaths of land and you've treated the Chinese as slaves to come over here and build it. I think that God's his whole pattern of the covenant is based on an inheritance. So I think that, you know, an inheritance of some sort is probably fine. But then, you know, the other side of that, God is wanting to be really careful. He doesn't want us to be dependent on our earthly parents.
No.
You know, he wants us to choose to be dependent upon him, and his inheritance is a whole lot greater. So I think I always told my sons that the worst thing I could possibly do for them would be to give them a large inheritance, because they would have never any sense of what they created on their own, or sense of the joy of really striving to build something. And it's so destructive to an individual sense of values and morality to give them a large inheritance that I said, I'm going to do you a favor and spend your inheritance. So I'll give you enough to help you, you know, build your first, buy your first home and to get started in business. I'll pay for your education and, you know, and get you set up. But beyond that, you're really going to need to earn your own way to have any sense of satisfaction or proper perspective in life. So I think that's what God's plan does.
Camping trips.
Yeah, exactly.
You're taking real fancy camping trips with you.
Yeah, absolutely. We're here in about a month. We're going on a family vacation. We're paying, and everybody is coming on. It'll be our great camping trip together. So I think God's presentation there. And then he had another aspect of it for those who were orphans and those who were widows and those who were needy. And it wasn't, he didn't give them money. But what he said is that I want you to leave, you know, a portion of your field unharvested. So they're going to have to go to do the work, but that they could go harvest some food. And then he wanted into a storehouse, wood for fires, wood for shelters, wool for clothing. And again, you had to, add labor, to make it worthwhile, but the materials were available to you. So it seems to me it's the ideal economic plan for us working together.
Yes.
Now that brings us back though to your point of the name ought to have been enough. It should have served as a trigger. It did serve as a trigger for you and it should for others. You know, I think that for a Christian, just to state emphatically that there was no one named Jesus and Christ isn't a name. And there was no one named Jesus Christ. And if they've lied to you about Jesus Christ, what else has your religion lied to you about?
Tons. Or had.
Yeah. And then your point is, every time you read, every time we're Yahweh, and there were 7,000 times in his witness that he provided us with his name, and all 7,000 times it's been changed to Satan's name, Lord. You know, if religious institutions have lied to you about that, you know, what else have they lied to you about? And why have they lied to you about it? You know, it ought to make you mad if you're religious.
Oh, it's not even just a made up name. It's, you know, they choose, you know, the fact that they chose Satan's title, Satan's
right.
name.
Or, yeah, and you know, at one time I thought that that Lord, because Lord is used as a title, that that Lord was Satan's title. And you know, that's not the way that you know, I'm telling you here that I'm changing from what I originally thought, because you know, I'm very comfortable with that. You know, the more you learn, the more you think, sometimes your understanding changes. And somebody wrote me a letter the other day and said, you know, is it how often do you really see Ha Baal, the Lord? And it's Baal, which is the Hebrew word for Lord, is mostly used as a name. Mm-hmm. And so it's a name for Satan. Satan's goal is to lord over men, to control men, to be worshipped as man is wont to worship a Lord. And it's the antithesis of what God wants. You know, the last thing God wants is to be seen as a Lord, because Lords control, Lords hold down their subjects, Lords are worshipped. He doesn't want any part of any of that. He wants to be Dad, you know, mm-hmm. father to a family. So to replace Yahweh's name 7,000 times with the name that God applies to Satan, oh man, what a horrible crime.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, and as I look at it, it just strikes me that if you were, and you're not now, and I'm not now, but I once was, if someone could prove, which is easily done, that there was no Jesus Christ, and that Satan's name is Lord, and that God has but one name, it's Yahweh, and that Yahusha means Yahweh saves, and that your religion has deliberately and knowingly kept this from you. If you're open-minded, if you're moral, if you're rational, if you're capable of exercising good judgment, there really is no option at that point other than to reject the religion for having lied about maybe the most important aspect of who God is and how we can come to know him.
But, you know, even when you share that, they'll give you credit that you're well-researched or something like that, but it falls on deaf ears. You must have to just want to know, because
I've had
terrible experiences where they just don't care.
Yeah. In fact, I find one of two responses. One response by Christian apologists is that, why do you think you're special because you have some unique understanding of how to pronounce God's name, like that's a big deal? And they'll demean Yahweh's name from that point of view. Now, God himself etched the third statement on the first of the two tablets, says that that belittling my name, having my name be for naught, in other words, changing my name to Satan's title, Lord, is an unforgivable sin. He says, I will never forgive anybody that does. So is it's a really big deal to Yahweh. He etched it in stone. And that's one of the two responses. And the other one is equally lame. It says, God knows who I'm talking about. You know, it doesn't care. God's not concerned with what we call him, just that we seek to know him. And you say, oh, come on, you moron. You're going to tell me you're seeking to know him, and you're calling him by a name that bears no similarity whatsoever to the name that he shared with you 7,000 times? I mean, he tells you his name 7,000 times, you're going to ignore it, and you tell me that you're seeking to know him? I mean, come on, think.
I hear you.
Yeah, one of the big issues of religion. Religion is like political patriotism. It's the same in this regard. And that when somebody is poisoned with it, when someone has put their faith into religion, for example, they're not just immune to evidence and reason, they're allergic to it. And they will do everything in their power to be able to disregard the truth. Evidence presented to them, even if the testimony, as you know, Kirk, comes directly from Yahweh. This is what Yahweh said. They will reject it. In fact, they'll despise it because it's a threat to their faith. Scary when you have to reject the truth to believe something. Welcome back to the final segment of Shattering Mist for today. We're having a conversation with Kirk, who's called in from California and has stayed with us as we talk about really shattering myths and how misled Christians in particular are in this country by their religion. And foremost amongst those is the thing that you mentioned. I don't think there's one Christian in a million who has ever heard anyone in their religion speak about the Yobel and what they mean. Did you ever hear anything about a Yobel? Year and what a Yobel represents when back in the time you were a Christian?
No, sir.
No. And how many times have you been to a Christian church or a Christian meeting where they spoke about the path to God beginning with the doorway that is Passover and going through matzah and yeasted bread and Bukurim, firstborn children?
Well, we were told about the feast, but they were irrelevant because what Paul said, you know, they're just not important. But a historical note, we were taught that.
So you only looked at these were things that were done in the life of the Jewish people. They were part of the Exodus, and that's pretty much it.
Yeah, that's pretty much it.
Yeah. So there was a Last Supper among your group, not a celebration of Passover.
Well, actually, we were taught the history of Easter as Talmud, Semiramis, and Nimrod dies, and he goes, and then she gets pregnant 2 years later, and she's got to do something.
Right.
She was impregnated by the sunbeam, and then you have Talmud born later, so she keeps the power. You know, it's kind of that sort of thing.
And that's that is the basis of Easter Sunday. Absolutely, it's also the basis of Christmas because 9 months later she gave birth to the Son of the Sun in recognition of Christmas. So they amongst the people you were with, there was some admittance that there were lots of lies and silly lies associated with Christianity and its festivals.
The festivals and Christmas were no one said don't do it. They just said that ain't none of it's true. You know.
Okay. You wonder.
I knew that to be a fact, but the minute you that didn't mean that most everybody didn't celebrate it or put up a tree. You know,
and of course, in Yirmiyah and Jeremiah, he specifically says, you know, what in the world's wrong with you? You cut down this tree and bring it in and you decorate it and you celebrate it. Are you crazy or what? You know?
Human condition is such, it's hard to,
right.
If you have a business and you don't put some hollyhocks or something up, you know, or whatever they are,
yeah.
You know, decorate a little bit, then your customers think, what's wrong with you?
Yeah, exactly. It's why God tells us we need to walk away from societal traditions, because they influence people's lives. They perpetuate the myth. But you know, you just look at the basis of Christianity and the fact that, you know, they claim that there's a New Testament, a new covenant, because of what Paul said, of course, and and yet, you know, you find God saying, no, I beg to differ. There's only one. You know, and this, the one I'm offering is eternal. It's unchanging. It's dependable. And, you know, here are the terms and conditions. Take it or leave it. But there's only one of them. You know, I guess the biggest issue I have with Christianity is how they think that God would be reliable if, as Paul, if what Paul writes is true, that everything God had said in his Torah and prophets is been negated, it's been nullified, it had no means to save anybody, but now he's authorized Paul to present an entirely new plan, and that plan is completely contradictory to the old plan. Who in their right mind would trust the new plan?
Well, it's hard because, I mean, you know, when you're a Christian, you just take it, what you know, take what they say, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, you were Presbyterian. So.
Absolutely.
You know, and I'm sure, did it bother you at the time, or did it?
I was bothered by many questions, like, how in the world could God have said, my God, why have you forsaken me? And then, which means that God separated himself from Yosha as he hung on the upright pole. And how then can you base a religion on God dying when God departed him before his body died? I was really troubled by that. I was really troubled by why, if the big issue within Christianity was the bodily resurrection and you wanted to prove it, why did all four eyewitness accounts of what happened that day say that no one recognized him? And why were we coming to a church on a Sunday when God said that we should observe the seventh day, the Shabbat?
Yeah, that one bothered me.
Yeah, so yeah, I had all those things rattling in my head, and no resolution to any of them until I read the Torah.